doing some quite intensive review of differential geometry. And, you know, so that's been quite, you know, quite a challenge. But it now means that I've gone over most, at least, of the sort of foundation of the theory that we're going to use. So what I want to do for the rest of the week is to start to try and put it in context. So today I'm going to go through three examples of calculating curvature using this Cartan formalism. So the nice thing about the Cartan formalism is it's a really effective way of calculating curvature. So it's very quick. Okay, it's not maybe quite as quick as using the Mathematica program. However, you can do quite general metrics. The problem with using an algebraic manipulator is you've often got to put in something reasonably specific. And you've usually, at least as far as I know, got to fix your dimension. So it's quite often useful to be able to sort of, if you want to sort of see more general structures, so maybe you want to think, well, you know, I think I want to go in more dimensions. I'm not sure how many. And you want to see perhaps how a certain property depends on dimension. It's quite useful to have analytic tools at hand to be able to sort of spot patterns. So a lot of physics is actually about spotting patterns and developing intuition for patterns. So today, as I say, I've chosen three examples. They're kind of a personal choice. I think they illustrate things. But the first one is something which is a fairly straightforward metric. But given that it's our first time of using Cartan, I think that's having something a little simpler is quite good. So if you like, today we are applying Cartan. So the first example I want to look at is, well, I'll call it a gravitational wave. And what I really mean by that is it's a vacuum solution to Einstein equations. It's not trivial. It's not static. And you, as you'll see from the way I write the metric, it looks like it's got a sort of very definite null type of dependence. So so here, dxi is just running from 1 to 2. So it's a four-dimensional metric. So it's something of relevance to us. And this is what I meant by you can sort of see the null dependence. Here we've got t minus r. So it's not, this is not a completely general function, this h, because it doesn't have completely general dependence on t and r. So it's just dependent on this specific combination. But other than that, for now at least, for our computation of the curvature, we're going to say that h is just some general function. And then we'll see what restrictions we have to put on it to make it a solution of the vacuum Einstein equations. So obviously, if the only answer was h equals 0, that would tell us there was no such vacuum solution of this form. But that's not going to be the case. We'll find there are non-trivial solutions for h, and then we'll see what form they actually take. So in using this Cartan formalism, typically the first thing we do is find an orthonormal basis just to make the calculation easier. If you remember, we showed that the symmetric part of those connection one forms, the, the matrices, so the one forms that have the two indices, was proportional to D of the components of GAB. So if we're in an orthonormal basis, D of GAB is 0. And the thetas are anti-symmetric. So, if you like, the first step is orthonormal basis. So if you look at those choices there, you'll see that by taking the combination eta AB, omega A, omega B, you actually recover that metric. So this is like the components of our metric. So that means I've got my orthonormal basis. I've sort of, this way I wrote the metric here has cross terms, dt, dr, cross terms. But it's quite easy to just sort of complete a square and find a sort of nice block diagonal form of the metric. But it's not in a coordinate basis, obviously. So now, our next step, if you remember Cartan's first structural equation, was relating the exterior derivative of the basis of the dual space, so the dual basis, with the connection one forms. So our next step is to use d omega a plus theta ab, wedge omega b equals 0 for our torsion-free connection. So I have to just calculate d of these objects. So if I look at omega t, d hits dt gives me 0 because d squared is 0. D hits d of t minus r, that also gives me 0. So the only non-zero piece is when the d hits the h. So the d hits the h, well, h depends on t minus r and on x1 and x2. I don't care about how it depends on t minus r here because I've already got a d of t minus r. And if I take a form and try to wedge it with itself, I get 0 because of the antisymmetry. So the only term I pick up is the derivative of h with respect to the x's. So that's just my d omega t. And then it's sort of obvious that the omega r is, in fact, exactly the same. And then d of omega I is 0. So now how am I going to extract this, the spin connection from this expression? Well, what I need to do is to just write this in terms of the basis. So I see my dxi there, and I know I can just replace that with omega I. I've got a d of t minus r here, so I need to be able to re-express that in terms of my basis. But then if I look at omega t and omega r, they both have this second term. So if I subtract them, that deletes this term, and I just get d of t minus r. So in other words, d of omega t is equal to minus a half h comma I omega t minus omega r cross omega I. So why did I flip this? Mm-hmm.
Sorry, is d omega t and d omega r meant to be the same expression on that board?
Sorry?
Is there meant to be any difference between those two equations?
There isn't. Have I written it? No, they're exactly the same. Yeah, d omega t and d omega r are the same. Because if you hit d omega r here, that bit goes, you don't get anything there. And so you're only taking d of the second piece, which is the same as the addition in the omega t. So although, these are different basis elements, then you can see that they have this term in common. And the reason is you're looking at your metric and completing the square. and you actually find that's a simple process. So D of those two is in fact identical. And so here, I'm just at the moment, obviously this is going to look the same for omega r, but what I'm trying to do is to get an expression that's going to have, you know, a direct relation with this one. And so what I can see here, this has to equal theta TA cross, sorry, minus theta TA cross omega A. So we know that from Cartan's first equation. And so I can see that that if I look at this second piece, this is summed over the other indices, I can see that that's coming to an I. So that's my A values. And so it's telling me that theta TI is equal to a half H comma I omega T minus omega R. It also tells me that theta TR is going to be zero. But then I can do exactly the same thing for the R component. And get the same expression. And it's sort of obvious from the expression for D of theta I that theta ij is also zero. So I've now finished calculating the connection in the orthonormal basis. So I'm just going to pause here to actually do a quick check, because that's what I have read off in a fairly glib fashion, actually, just saying, oh, well, d omega t has to be theta ta. I just see an omega I here, so I know that's theta ti. And so I write it down. And so let's just check . So d omega I is supposed to be minus theta IA cross omega A, right? And that's supposed to be zero. Now, remember these are anti-symmetric, so they're not zero. I can see that some of these terms in here are potentially not zero. So let me just check that this is all sort of working out. So theta, if I look at this, this should be theta IT cross omega T minus theta IR cross omega R. So here, theta IT equals eta IJ theta IT, JT, sorry. And that equals eta ij eta tt theta jt. Actually, one minute, one step in between. I said that these thetas were anti-symmetric, so this is minus eta ij theta tj, which is then minus eta ij eta tt theta tj, but then that's plus one, that's minus one, so that's theta tj. I'm laboring this a little bit because these are just things that you kind of, you know, do instantly, essentially, once you've just convinced yourself that it's the right thing to do. So similarly, theta IR, in this case, is going to be minus theta RJ, because you go, it's essentially following all the same steps here, except instead of an eta TT, you've got an eta RR. So you have two minus ones. So now you can see that d omega I is going to be, you know that both the theta TJ and theta RJ are the same. They're this expression here. So theta IT was equal to the same, actually, I should put an I there, shouldn't I? Be correct. But when I substitute in, both of these were minus signs originally, but because of this minus sign here, you get a relative flip. So you see you've got omega t minus omega r cross omega t minus omega r, which is indeed zero. So that's the connection. And now we use Cartan's second. What's that? Second equation. Which is telling you about what the curvature is, d theta plus theta wedge theta. And so we simply go through, again, the curvature two forms, at least for our metric connection here.
Just wondering, so how can we... So you identify the terms in front of the middle slide.
The middle bit, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You identify the terms in front of the wedge omega, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So I was just wondering, how are we sure we can do that? For example, what if the first term had, for example, omega I in it? It would have dropped out, and then...
Right. So what I'm hoping to do by going through three examples is kind of sort of build up your sort of how you see these things, right? So in this case, this is a reasonably straightforward metric. There's not a lot going on. There's one function, one cross term. Usually, I mean, the way that is written, d of omega t is this form times omega I. I mean, in reality, what you've really got are a set of simultaneous equations, right? Which, you know, in terms of for each of those, if you look at the Cartan equation, you've got, a, you know, labeled by the A index, you've got n simultaneous equations, and you're just trying to extract the components of theta AB. So, yes, in general, you know, if you had a completely disgusting general expression, you might have to work a bit harder to find the thetas. I guess what I'm saying is, in a lot of very interesting cases, it's sort of obvious by inspection what they are. So, and I've kind of picked three sort of candidate examples to start building up how you see this, or how this is obvious, you know, how you begin to see what, you know, how to just pick these up without doing a lot of work. Okay. If you tried to do something else, if you tried to sort of take some different set of thetas out of that expression, you'd very soon realize, oh, that doesn't work. Okay. And so in this case, it's sort of a question of rewriting D of the omega A's so that it's sort of you can immediately pick these things out. And I think that just, you know, in these cases, it's reasonably obvious. I think that my third example, it's a little less obvious. And so it's just, it's kind of a little bit of practice that becomes obvious.
So it's not completely justified?
Well, it's completely justified because it works. Sorry, I mean, you know, it works. So if, you know, you could have just written it down if you wanted to be sort of pedantic, you could have written down, as I say, C1 as a set of simultaneous equations and solved them for the thetas, and you would get exactly the same answer. But I guess this is where, you know, it comes to doing physics. You simply, if you can spot it immediately, you do it. The only caveat is, and that's what that third bit is, you can spot or guess an answer, but always check. In fact, that third board is the single most important lesson you can learn in doing research, is to check, check, and check again, and to always do sort of simple checks on your calculation before you go too far. So if I'd put that down as a guess and it hadn't worked, I would have thought, okay, go back, you know, back to square one, try again, right? So I'm demonstrating it works, and therefore those are my connection coefficients, and that is a completely, if I demonstrate a solution to a set of equations, that's perfectly acceptable as a method of proof. I don't have to sit and write down n differential equations. It's not differential, n simultaneous equations.
Mm-hmm. One more thing that Ruben was asking was, why can't we just include any pair proportional to, say, omega I in theta ti?
So
that
in
wouldn't have worked in the check.
So
that's what you're saying, right? When we are adding theta ti, we also had any term proportional to omega I, it would have still been a solution because omega I wedge omega I is zero.
But then you'd have a problem with the right-hand board,
okay,
right? Because then you would pick up an omega I cross omega t term there that you couldn't possibly cancel with anything else. So that's what I meant about the simultaneous equations. That's, if you know, if you would, in general, you would have a sort of, you know, your, if you think about what that, say, let's take d, you know, d omega 1, is equal to minus theta 1, 2, omega 2, minus theta 1, 3, omega 3, da-da-da-da-da, right? And so, you know, what you're, what this, and then d omega 2 is minus theta 2, 1, omega 1, minus theta 2, 3, omega 3. These are simultaneous equations, which, and so the idea is you've computed this, and this is expressible in terms of some set of basis of the basis one forms, and so you are you're basically just doing elimination to find the thetas. So that's what, if you weren't sure and you had a particularly messy metric, that's what you would have to do. But in this case, I'm saying, it's like if you had a set of simultaneous equations which were particularly straightforward, you wouldn't waste time doing, you know, elimination. You would just say, x equals 1, y equals 2. Actually, my son used to get into trouble for that a lot when he was studying maths at school, because you could just see the answers. And they said, well, that's not good enough. You're supposed to do the elimination. But I probably trained them too well, you see, in that sense. Take the easiest route. So, yeah, I mean, I hope that's... Okay, so in this case, what we've got two non-trivial connection components, theta ti and theta ri, and so these are going to feed into our curvature over here. So let's start with RTI. So first thing I do, and I'll do it in detail for the first one, is I just simply take the T component of the second Cartan equation. And so I've got this. I look at the second term and very quickly realize that that's zero, because the only non-zero possibility here is one or two, right? And this theta ji vanishes. So that's zero. And so I've just got to take d of what I've calculated up there, so that's d of this half h comma I, so that's what I get. And again, that's reasonably clearly a half h comma ij omega j cross omega t minus omega r. It's also reasonably clear that that is the same, or going to be the same, as r ri. It's slightly less obvious in that you have to look at it and convince yourself that also, this is a bad piece of chalk suddenly, also R, T, R, and R, I, J are also zero. And basically, you can see that because there's only two non-zero connection components. And they're both proportional to, well, they're actually identical. So you're never going to get a non-zero theta wedge theta term. And so since theta TR and theta IJ are zero, that tells you that those parts of the curvature 2 form are also zero. So that means I've now computed the curvature of this metric. But let me try and extract it. So here, remember, RAB is a half RABCD omega C cross omega D. That's just what it means. So here we've got that RTI is a half HIJ. We've got an omega j, omega t, and an omega j cross an omega r. So I can see that rti, oops, and then I've got an omega j and an omega t is a half h comma ij, and that's minus RTIJR, this is the relative minus sign in there. And then looking at the, since this is the same as RRI, I can read off those components. Now, the only thing, again, I want to sort of make a point here, because at this point, you might well be thinking these are the coordinate, this is the Riemann tensor in the coordinate basis. So, I just want to emphasize this expression here with those omegas was in an orthonormal basis. We'll see that a bit more later on, but for now, I'm simply going to say, well, actually, I'm looking for a vacuum solution, so I'm just going to look at, I can still find my Ricci tensor even in this orthonormal basis because it's still a contraction on the first and third indices. So I can find Ricci. So R I J is minus a half H I J. Then I guess I can find So RTT is going to be equal to, if I do it downstairs. So if I want to look at RTT, what I've got to do here is take, first of all, bring this index down. That just gives me plus one. Swapping those two indices gives me a minus sign. Raising the I index gives me another minus sign, and then I sum. So I think I had two, so that's the same sign as this. Except so that's the Laplacian of H. And that's also equal to RRR. Hang on. I'm sorry. I was looking at just this first component. If I want Rij, I've got to also not just take the TT sum, I've got to take the RR sum as well. So, and essentially that's swapping those last two indices in both cases, but because this is equal to minus that, they cancel out. I was looking at that and thinking, hang on, what's doing I'm doing there? Okay. So what this tells me, I don't care whether I'm in an orthonormal basis or a coordinate basis, my Riemann has to be zero. It's a geometric object. And so I can solve the vacuum Einstein equations if the Laplacian of H vanishes. So there's two sort of classic simple solutions. So I've just taken something to say, you know, to try and emphasize two different solutions which are kind of linearly independent. So a half H1 comma IJ in this case is 1 0 0 minus 1, and a half H2 comma IJ is 0 1 1 0. So why did I write those down? Well, this is where I'm coming to the bit about being a gravitational wave. The Ricci tensor is zero, but the Riemann tensor has these pieces of a half H comma IJ in them. And so the Riemann tensor is telling you about the curvature of space, in this case, the curvature of space in vacuum. And so we're saying that the Riemann curvature of our background is non-trivial, and it's got these sort of principal axes, or the equivalent of principal axes. And so in this case, we've got some, this is our H1 of T minus of X1 and X2, but we've got some sort of very completely general dependence on T minus R. And so here, if directions in our X-axis are being increased, directions in our y-axis are being decreased. So this is telling us about tidal forces. Riemann curvature is telling us about tidal forces. And so the basic action of this H1 is, if we started with a circle in our X1, X2 plane, it would be, if it was stretched in the x direction, it would be squeezed in the y direction, so it would flatten out, and then it goes back to a circle like this. So if we had a sort of periodic motion, the effect of that, so if we had some sort of sinusoidal dependence, the effect of H1 would be to have this sort of breathing mode based along the axes. So that's like this plus mode. On the other hand, here, X and Y are either both being stretched or both being squashed. And so what we get is instead a sort of cross, an oscillatory behavior on the sort of the cross axes in the X1, X2 plane. And so this is just a one way, at least, of describing what the physical degrees of freedom are of the gravitational field. So gravity, you might have heard is a, said, is a quadrupole force, or sort of quadrupole in nature, and that's what this is showing. You're sort of getting, these are two independent polarization states. One is kind of wobbling sort of in sync with the axes, and one is wobbling just a little bit out of sync with the axes. And it's sort of one of these peculiarities that this is a sort of solution independent of the profile in the T minus R direction. So although gravity is nonlinear, if you're particularly shrewd about how you choose to, or what your solution depends upon, you can sometimes get something which is sort of actually much more general than you might think. So this H, this gravitation, this profile can be anything in the T minus R direction. What you can't then do is add two together. Yeah, I'm just saying what I'm trying to do is to break it down into the sort of basic nature of the solution. So I've just chosen two candidate solutions which are, in some sense, linearly independent. So, I mean, yeah, it's, you know, I'm sort of not really focusing too much on the dependence of H, I guess, in this case, because I've not said anything about how it, you know, its profile in T minus R either. They're probably not the most natural basic functions to choose, but I simply chose them because the second derivative matrix had this, you know, exact sort of nice either sort of cross or plus form. So it's really meant to be illustrative of the properties of a gravitational wave. I mean, in practice, when you're doing gravitational waves, you tend to do them, you're not just interested in some sort of plain polarized wave. You actually want to look at a whole range of different gravitational waves. And then the only way you can do it is in perturbation theory. So then you write your gravitational wave as a little perturbation around the background. And then it's probably a little more clear what you're polarization states are, so it's meant to be illustrative. So my second example is, I'm going to call it warped compactification. So this example is meant to illustrate so I'll write it down and then explain what it's meant to illustrate. So this type of thing crops up quite a lot when you're looking at extra dimensions and gravity. You can also sometimes reduce things even in four-dimensional gravity, to something of this form. For example, when you do, those of you that do the cosmology course, you'll see that we describe the metric of our universe in terms of a cosmological time, so this wouldn't be a spatial direction, a cosmological time minus some scale factor times some other space. And so the scale factor depends only on time, and this is some other kind of three-dimensional geometry, which in cosmology is either flat, spherical, or hyperbolic. And so this setup sort of seems, you know, crops up either as the overall metric or as some sort of subcomponent of, or some subspace of your manifold. So examples where you come across this, literally like this, this is sort of used in, or has been used in brain world scenarios. Also slightly more complicated, but notionally similar structure. If you look at compactifications in string theory, they often have some of these warp factors. There might be a segment multiplying your own space-time bit and another segment multiplying the internal part. So the metrics that you come across are more complicated, but the sort of methodology can all be boiled down to this. So I'm trying to sort of deconstruct things that you do. So in again, orthonormal basis. I'm going to be a bit faster this time. So the idea here is that what we want to do is we want to find an n-dimensional connection and curvature in terms of what we call the warp factor A and n minus one dimensional expressions. So this g mu nu depends only on the x's. I'm not going to specify what it is. So for example, this is where your algebraic manipulation programs might not be so helpful. All I'm doing is I'm saying this omega naught is an orthonormal basis for our g mu nu here, our lower dimensional g. So if you like, you might think of it as being EA mu dx mu, or omega A mu dx mu. I guess people doing supergravity would choose that one. But really, I don't care what it is. It's just a basis for the lower dimensional metric. So I go ahead, I compute my, do the same thing, Cartan 1. So I take d of omega a. So if I look d of omega a, I'm obviously going to get a derivative of a. So that's a prime dr cross omega naught. And then I've got to take a d of omega naught. But then I write that as a primed on a omega a cross omega r. And then d of omega naught is minus theta naught a b cross omega naught b. But I've got that a floating out in front, so I pull that with my omega naught to get the omega b. And of course, d omega r is zero. So once again, by inspection, rather than solving a set of simultaneous equations, I simply peel off that theta AB is theta naught AB. That bit's fairly straightforward from there. And that, see this one. Theta AR is A primed on A, omega A. So you can see that that's perfectly consistent with D omega R vanishing, because the only thing that would depend on would be a theta RA, and that's proportional to omega A. So you'd get zero. That's my connection. Okay, so again, this is now looking for the curvature. I'm looking at Cartan's second equation. So for the AB components, I have that theta AB is theta naught, so I take d theta naught. The theta wedge theta is, again, has two parts to the sum. I'm summing over the this lower dimensional part, so that's that term, and then I've got this piece here. So you can see that this term here is just R naught AB, because that's the expression for the lower dimensional curvature two forms. And then I've got to look at what is theta AR cross theta RB. Well, theta AR is just A primed on A times omega A. So you can see that this term here is going to have an A primed on A squared in it. So the first term is omega A. And then I've got to look at what happens with the second term. Well, I know what theta BR is, where the B index is upstairs. So what I've got to do is I pull that R index down, just to ask what is it. I've got to swap the ordering. So pulling the R index down gives me one minus sign. Swapping the ordering gives me another minus sign. And then my B index here has to be lowered. So I can see that this is what I have. Okay, so I've just rewritten it so that when I come to picking off the individual components, it's going to be a little easier to see what's going on. So the only other thing I've got to compute is our AR, which is going to be d of theta AR and then plus this extra piece. Okay. So that gives me A double primed on A. Actually, hang on. If I input what my omega A is, my omega A is A times omega naught. So that's actually A double primed omega naught A. And then I've got minus A primed theta naught AB cross omega naught B. So I'm now taking D of omega naught A. And then I've got to write my second piece. So that's theta AB is theta naught AB. And then theta BR is A primed on A omega B. But you can see that because of the hidden A here, as opposed to you know, the omega naught there, that's A omega naught. This term is the same as that term. And so that is simply A double primed on A omega A. Sorry. Yes, there's a dr, isn't there? It's A double prime dr, isn't it? I was looking at that and I thought, well, how have I got a one form at the end? That doesn't make sense. Okay, so that's... So that's now finished computing the curvature two forms. And so what I've got to do is to peel off what the actual curvature tensor is. And so...
What happened to the A prime squared over A squared there?
Omega naught. This has a hidden A in it. It's omega A.
Oh, and, oh so yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, so what I want to do now is to peel off the different curvature components. Yeah, that's why I was. I've got to try and make sure I remember to put the omega, the naught, or the subscript on the omega. So if I want to pick off the components of my Riemann tensor again, with respect to this orthonormal basis, I've got to realize that that's an omega naught and not an omega. So I have to I have to multiply by A to give me the omega, which gives me this 1 over A squared here. So that's taking into account this first bit. Then I've got to get the second bit, which is my A primed on A squared. But now I've got to figure out a way to get this particular combination of indices and... I've just simply got to ensure that my Riemann tensor is anti-symmetric in C and D. So that's the only little niggly thing going on there, that I want an A primed on A squared term. I want something that's just fairly kind of geometric, but I've got to make sure it has the right symmetry. So that's what I end up with. And then finally, I've got this other term that I calculated. So that tells me that RA, RBR is minus, I think it's minus, A double primed on A, delta AB. So that's my Riemann tensor. So now I'd like to just change that. Again, this is all in an orthonormal basis. So to get my coordinate, that's really what I guess what I'm meaning when I say orthonormal versus coordinate basis. If you know, in the case that you have just a sort of straightforward block diagonal metric, it simply means either multiplying or dividing by a sort of appropriate factor. So I'm going to get that my So here you've got a 1 over a squared, but if I look here, my omega a mu is given by sort of a times my omega naughts. And so these e's each sort of carry a factor of 1 on a. And so overall, this tells me that there's a factor of 1 on a squared for R in the orthonormal basis relative to R in the more natural coordinate basis. And so this 1 on a squared is really coming from the factor in this orthonormal basis. So if I calculate my Ricci tensor, so if I look, that's simply going to give me, let me calculate it downstairs. Okay, so the first term is obvious. So for the second term, if I sum over mu and lambda, I get, for the first term in brackets, I get the dimensionality of the space times g nu tau. And for the second term, I just get minus g nu tau. So here I've got n minus 1, a prime squared. All right. Oh, sorry, n minus 2, because it's the dimensionality of the g, which is already n minus 1. And then I've also got a contribution coming from the RR component. And so one of the things that you notice about this is, suppose I had a solution to Einstein's equation for this metric where g equaled eta, okay? So here I'm not supposing that I'm solving the vacuum Einstein equations in higher dimensions, right? Maybe I've got a cosmological constant. Maybe I'm doing something a little bit more complicated. But as long as whatever I've got solves the higher dimensional Einstein equations, I can replace the flat metric in my lower dimensional metric with any Einstein metric, and I've still got a solution. So, for example, since I'm out of time, I'll just say a couple more about this. So, for example, if I set A of R is equal to E to the minus KR, then that tells me that with, let's say, G equals eta for now, then my, if I take, instead, let me take one index up and one index down, my Ricci component is equal to n minus 1 k squared, and my sort of space-time or mu nu Ricci components are going to equal, well, here I've chosen it so that a prime squared is actually the same as a double primed, so I've actually also got n minus 1 k squared. So that's a constant curvature space. And in this case, this is actually, so it's constant curvature, but it's constant negative curvature. So what I've written down is a negative cosmological constant solution, which is anti-de Sitter space. Now, in this case, if you look at the original metric, what you're seeing is that your space-time looks like flat planes, but that kind of gets squashed very rapidly as you move in the r direction. But what is also true is I could choose any Einstein metric, and it would simply be sort of transported or copied all the way along, but with this squashing factor. So that's why we call it a warp factor, because it's something that's kind of changing. You're taking a particular space in the mu nu directions, and then you're kind of either blowing it up or squeezing it down as you move along in the R. So that's what that particular example is.
A general example for Robertson-Walker metric where you have constant sectional curvature?
Sorry?
Is this like the Robertson-Walker metric where you have constant sectional curvature for your spatial spaces?
So, well, yes, that's what I said when I first wrote down the metric, that you could, you know, that this form, if you swapped R for T, is exactly Friedman-Robertson-Walker. So you just swap the role, you just pop a T out in front instead of an R. And many of the space-times that you want to look at, actually, in higher dimensions, they're not exactly of this form, but you can see that this is like a building block of them. It's some sort of part of them. So that's why I chose this particular example. So I'm going to stop there, obviously, because I'm out of time. So tomorrow I want to look a bit at more about curvature, really, in the sense of trying, we talked a bit here about tidal forces and stuff. So I don't know whether this is true, but I got the feedback that maybe it'd be a good thing to think a little bit about what curvature means or the physics of curvature. So we'll take a bit of a look at, you know, all this. This is all a lot of formalism. How do we extract a picture of what's actually going on from these expressions?